Our next speaker is Dr. Margie Beavis, who's the Vice President of the Medical Association for Prevention of War and has a long involvement in the ICAN, which is the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And welcome, Margie. And Margie's going to speak about the risks of nuclear power. And as soon as I open up her PowerPoint, I'll start screen sharing that. Can I ask someone to let me know if Margie's screen sh is Margie's PowerPoint is screen sharing at the moment?
No, it's not.
No. Okay, we will see if we can fix that. How about
Now
now?
it is, yep.
Fantastic. Thanks, Maggie.
Okay, thank you for the intro, Jim. I'd like to acknowledge the country, the Boonwurrung people, and that this is unceded land, and respects to their care for the land. I hope everybody can hear me okay. Next slide. So basically, I've been asked to talk about accidents, warfare, and the military industrial complex. I mean, who could think this combination might be a problem? So just close to home, recognize that your own house, where you live, is not covered by for nuclear accidents, and that's because insurance companies know that they can and do happen, and when they do happen, they're really catastrophic. Next slide.
Sorry, Maggie.
That's okay. All complex systems fail at some point for a whole variety of reasons. You think about planes that have had accidents, or had pilots that were potentially very depressed and suicidal, or whatever. We know there's been really big accidents, Windscale, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, but there've been a lot more. There's been about 15 accidents, with serious fuel or reactor damage, and really major risk of with each of those of uncontrolled radioactive release. Next slide. Depends how you define the accident as how often they happen, but 216 over 60 years doesn't sound so great for ones that may have threatened safety and really suggests there's probably one event per year. And if you're looking at the really big ones, like Fukushima, there's about a 50-50 chance of another happening within the next 62 years. I think that's actually a very conservative estimate. Similarly, if you look at core meltdowns, of which there have been more than 20, every reactor that's had a core meltdown has to be shut down. It's no longer usable. But one in 1,300 reactor years. So that takes into account the number of reactors around the world, which Jim probably knows is something about 400 or 500. Is that right, Jim?
Something like that.
Yeah. So probably every couple of years, we're looking at the potential for a meltdown of sorts. How much radiation is released from those meltdowns is variable, but it's pretty scary in terms of the actual lived experience statistics. I mean, the nuclear salesman will tell you how safe nuclear power are and how the new reactors are all much safer than the old reactors. Well, coming from general practice, I know that new drugs are always much safer than the old drugs. And really, until you've actually got lived experience, you don't know whether it is or it isn't. These two maps come courtesy of Jim, along with some of my other slides. But looking at the nuclear exclusion zones, it's also interesting how wind impacts on the areas that end up as long-term exclusion zones where people can no longer live. And so these orange areas are contaminated and will be contaminated for generations. People should not live there. What's a bit depressing about the Japanese green shaded area, when people were evacuated, they were offered compensation, and the Japanese very cynically lifted the permissible limits for civilians to get exposures. And that meant by lifting, I think it went from 1 millisievert to 20 millisieverts per year. That meant that those areas in the green, whilst they were certainly contaminated, no longer qualified for compensation or relocation assistance. What's happened in those areas is that mostly old people have moved back because with that level of radiation, effectively for children, it's very toxic. If you look at the statistics, for that level of radiation, perhaps of a classroom of 30 children, one of them would end up with a cancer they otherwise wouldn't have got, and one of them will end up with a heart attack or a stroke they wouldn't have got from that exposure during their childhood. These graphs, again, thanks, Jim, look at accident fallout. So this is Loy Yang in Victoria with a prevailing southerly. And it's really quite disturbing to see how this fallout spreads over the southern and southeastern and really extending across to the west of Melbourne. Next slide, Jim. And this is for South Australia. I don't know if a northerly is frequent in South Australia, but they're certainly frequent enough in Victoria. But this is with the northerly winds. You can see that there's really extensive fallout over a large part of the state coming from Port Augusta. And if you want to look more at this, there's a wonderful website called nuclearplume.au, which has all sorts of different scenarios. So why do we fret about radiation? Basically because increased rates of all sorts of cancers, particularly blood cancers and thyroid cancers. And more recently, it's quite clear that there's also increased strokes and heart attacks from radiation exposure. In France, recently they decided to give 2.2 million people iodine to have in their houses. Why did they do that? Because those living within 20 or 30 kilometres of a power plant, if there is an accident, you have to take the iodine within 24 hours. If you take it after 24 hours, it makes it worse. It concentrates the radioactive materials more in your thyroid. So people have to have it at home. Next slide, Jim. So the questions then come up, will Australia, if we did have power plants, would they be honest enough to actually hand out the iodine tablets? How would you let everybody in the area know that they needed to take the iodine? And how would you let them know in time? So it's a major problem, and that's just the only thing that that's protective of is the thyroid cancers. It's not even protective of the other hazards. We've already talked about climate change risks, so I think I can skip that slide because we've done that. But what's often, in fact, almost uniformly, radiation is sort of health washed, if you like. There's repeated claims over and over again, particularly with radiotherapy, nuclear medicine, linking it to nuclear power. The line in the middle, nuclear energy already plays a major role in medicine and healthcare, was used by the opposition last election, and this is a post from Katie Allen, who was standing at the last election. We have a small, low-enriched uranium research reactor at Lucas Heights, and the radionuclides that come out of that often are very useful, particularly in some sorts of cancers. But it's completely separate to nuclear power. The other thing that's often health washed is when they talk about nuclear waste. Over and over again, they will say, and they're doing it for the submarines as well, it's just like hospital waste. Well, it's not like hospital waste. There's many different grades of waste, and none of the nuclear radioactive waste that comes from a nuclear reactor is hot. Equivalent to hospital waste. Hospital waste, the radioactivity runs down so quickly that after a couple of months you can put it in a normal rubbish tip. Okay, so again, we've already talked about the climate impacts for nuclear power stations. And we're fortunate to have the Australian Security Leaders Climate Group, which is a really impressive group of people who are very sensible in what they advocate. So there's the climate impacts and then there's security consequences. So I'll tend to go on more about the security consequences. Next slide, Jim. So it sounds obvious, but every reactor is a potential dirty bomb. Because if you rupture the containment, the release of radiation can be ferocious. They are a clear, accessible, and fixed target. And with the development of drones and much cheaper ways of attacking facilities, these facilities are not protected against attack. And as has already been noted, in Australia particularly, the development of nuclear reactors is really so slow that they're proxy for coal and gas. They're not the one of the reasons they're very popular is the coal and gas lobby love it because we would need to keep coal and gas. It's a way of derailing renewables and keeping us more dependent on coal and gas. Even when they're chugging along nicely, things go wrong. Lucas Heights, there have been 10 separate security incidents, and that's between 83 and 2007. But what's a little bit scary is that they're getting much more sophisticated technologies, particularly with AI-enabled tools for cyber attack, and as I've mentioned earlier, missiles and drones, that these fixed nuclear reactors are going to get easier to attack rather than safer. Just touching on nuclear waste, nobody wants it. I think for more than 40 years, the Australian government's been trying to find a home for low-level nuclear waste, which needs 300 years of isolation, and intermediate-level waste. And the First Nations communities have basically said we are not going to accept this on our lands because of the damage it does. It has the potential for health impacts for a very long time. And also, it's worth noting that the British weapons testing in Australia have had lasting and ongoing health issues and really are a national disgrace. Next slide, Jim. So, what happens when you finish with the fuel in a reactor? It goes into a cooling pool. Water is enough to stop the radiation coming out. So, just going back a bit, Jim. So this is basically a pool full of fuel rods from a reactor. These cooling pools, they need to cool for about a decade before they can be put in canisters in the next slide. But these cooling pools are very vulnerable. If the water drains from those cooling pools, they can heat up, explode, and release radiation just as much as a reactor can, if not more. There are very large sets of cooling pools next to almost every reactor globally, and they are very vulnerable. So if they lose the ability to cool either the reactor or the cooling pools, it's a very big problem. Next slide, Jim. So you will have all, like the previous speaker, you'll probably know a lot of this stuff. Zaporizhia has been under multiple drone strikes in Ukraine since 2022, and each side accuses the other. It's lost power almost 10 times, and the loss of the reservoir dam in 2023 was meant that they're now using groundwater wells to supply the cooling water. So this power plant continues to be, it's a very big power plant, it continues to be under attack, and it can't run away. It's not like it can go and hide. It's just there, so it's being fought over and at risk. And there's also been an attack on Chernobyl, but that's a separate issue. Next slide, please.
Maggie, the latest count is power has been cut off from Zaporizhia 13 times.
Oh, gracious. Yes, that was the last IEA report that I could find, but that makes sense. Okay, so with any reactor, you've got direct damage to the reactor, and then to the reactor safety system, and then to the power system, and then to plant personnel. And certainly, Russia and others do attack the staff, and particularly the engineers. And then, as I mentioned, damage to the spent fuel pool or to the cooling system. So there's lots of ways these can go wrong and really spread a lot of radiation across the region. Here in Australia, John Gorton wanted to put a nuclear reactor at Jervis Bay way back when. And one of the justifications he said was, well, if we wanted to get a nuclear weapon later, it would be really handy to have a power plant existed. And thinking back on that, if we had a nuclear power plant, or if we get nuclear power plants, they are so much more expensive than other forms of power. Our neighbours would think, why do they want to get this really expensive form of power? And you may potentially start both a nuclear power race, but also a nuclear arms race. As climate change gets worse, there's going to be increased force displacements and increased conflicts over these reactors. Here's another one of Jim's slides, which explains quite nicely why nuclear power reactors are so entrenched and entwined with the weapons problems. Basically, you need to be able to enrich uranium to create fuel for the reactors. And the spent fuel can also be reprocessed with plutonium, which is very suitable for bombs. you can remove the plutonium and then save that for the bombs. Similarly, if you've got enrichment already for developing power with the fuel rods, then you can potentially go on to enrich uranium to produce weapons. They continually, on so many levels, AUKUS, nuclear, all sorts of things. I'm astonished at how people can say black is white or turn a blind eye to what is the bleeding obvious. Nuclear power capabilities are the stepping stone for every nuclear weapons country to getting nuclear weapons. So pretending that's otherwise is just nonsense. Next slide. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has got very limited powers and not much money. So it's the basic rights for inspection are limited. The safeguard system needs reinforcement. Efforts to improve the system have been half-hearted and basically operates on the budget equivalent to the local police department. When you think it's a global organization, it's pretty depressing. And again, Jim, thanks for this slide. The White House has said that every weapons proliferation program was connected to a civilian reactor program. And if we did use nuclear as much as everyone's pushing us to use it, we'd have a proliferation risk really off the scale. And that came from Al Gore. There have been conventional military strikes in Iraq, Israel, and Syria, particularly driven by proliferation fears.
We could
Next
add
one,
a few
Jim.
more to that, I think, Margie. We could add Iran, recently strikes
Oh,
on the
yes. I'm going
UAE's
to get to
nuclear
Iran.
plant. Oh, sorry.
Absolutely. Next slide. Basically, Trump is a menace. And not that I'm telling any of you anything about that, but he abandoned the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Arrangement when first in office. I've got that acronym slightly wrong, but never mind. And then it took him till 2025 when he started to really reopen talks. The Israelis were totally opposed to that and basically started attacking Iran in June 2025. We now face a war ostensibly over nuclear enrichment. A week after Israel started attacking Iran, the US joined with really massive strikes on three nuclear sites. And this Donald Trump is the first US president to attack another country's nuclear program and also the first one to join Israel explicitly attacking an adversary. And it goes on, as you all know. We've got further attacks. We have now Iranian drone strikes, not just against military facilities in many countries, but also against energy and civilian infrastructure, including airports and oil facilities. And Egypt and Iraq are now also being involved. So it's broadening into a region-wide conflict. And whether Pickaxe Mountain, which some of you will have read about, which is a very deep underground facility that Iran may or may not be putting enrichment centrifuges in, is being talked of being attacked. But basically, the experts say even the bunker busters the US is so proud of would not get to Pickaxe Mountain. So whether that leads, they say the only way you'd get Pickaxe Mountain would be troops on the ground. So heaven forbid that's the next step. Next one, Jim.
Nuclear or a nuclear
Sorry.
bomb, Maggie?
Don't know. I don't know how good nuclear bombs are at penetrating at ground level. I think they tend to be either exploded. They're usually exploded either above ground or at ground level, but I don't know that they'd go terribly deep. I'm the wrong person to ask about that, Jim. I don't know. And someone in the audience might know, but I don't know that a nuclear weapon would be sufficiently able to penetrate. I suppose it would depend on the warhead. I don't know. Okay, what is breathtaking is the stupidity and the greed driving the Saudi Arabia deal. It's very opaque. Surprise, surprise. The US nuclear industry is very keen on the deal. When Trump faced a backlash, he basically then said, oh, well, it's linked to Saudi Arabia recognizing Israel under the Abraham Accords, and there'll be no enrichment. But who knows where the truth lies? We do understand that it doesn't require signing to the IAEA additional protocol, which is a very important addition because it allows much more rigorous inspections and spontaneous inspections. And 140 four countries have signed on to that protocol. And when the US gave United Arab Emirates access to nuclear reactor technology, they prohibited uranium enrichment and spent fuel reprocessing. So Saudi Arabia says we've had some dealings with Pakistan, and that itself is concerning. They're sort of saying if the US doesn't give it to us, we'll go to Pakistan or other sources. So, but it's basically you have to ask for both Saudis and UAE when nuclear is so much more expensive and they have such ample solar. If nothing else, why would they want nuclear if it is not for a weapons program? Again, this is stuff, other threats, accidents, unstable leaders. One of the most terrifying things during COVID I saw was Trump, who was sick with COVID, had low blood oxygen, which make people irrational, was on steroids, which makes people irrational, and has his underlying personality, which is probably pretty irrational too. He was trotting into hospital with the nuclear codes being carried by a Marine who was trailing around behind him. That was just so should have gone to the vice president. Anyway, nuclear theft, terrorism, sabotage, AI-enabled cyber tools. And interestingly, AI itself, at some point, there's a whole lot to unpack there. So we're already told it's too slow and too expensive, but I would add to what has been said by Paul to say it's also too dirty and too dangerous. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maggie. Not just for your talk just then, but for decades of fighting the good fight.
You too, Jim. Right back at you.